Coming up this episode. It's so, actually round the corner in Watford.
Well, not anymore.
It?
They knocked it down. Oh. But, wasn't that good?
Okay, moving over that.
It's gone to landfill.
There's a club. There's a club no architect wants to be in. It's called the Rubble Club. So no architect wants to see a building they've designed knocked down. Club. And unfortunately, I'm in the Rubble Club already. I've designed a village for disabled children.
Wow.
It's a lot of disabled children just get abandoned because they can't
look after them.
The parents can't look after them and the kids can't work on the land and all this stuff, so they just get abandoned. I think they saw how much we were eating and drinking and thought, let's get rid of us.
We did a lot of sushi in that place, remember.
Hello, welcome back to Wall Plug and Grommet Podcast. I'm Roger Bradbury, owner of Wren Construction and Chime Software.
Hello, I am Ellie, and this is a podcast where we chat through a top topic in construction and see if we can give you some nuggets of wisdom, as well as getting in an industry expert to see why they got into construction and what advice they can give us. So, Rog, how are you doing?
All good. How are you doing, Bells?
I'm all right. Had my jab on
Friday.
Oh,
have you? Oh, interesting.
I did it. You wimped out, didn't you?
I can't remember if we talked about this. Oh, yeah, I did. We're not going to go down that route, are we? To jab or not to jab?
I mean, I don't really see the debate, but anyway,
I hear you.
It was fine.
I'm scared of needles, as we discussed last time, I believe. And we're still alive anyway.
I'm still alive. I had Astra as well, so...
AZ.
The AZ.
Oxford, made in Britain. That's the one you want. That's got to be the one you want. I've been super busy this week. We're super busy at the moment, so that's cool.
That's very good.
Yeah, it seems to be work coming through the door, tenders coming through the door. Jobs finishing, jobs starting, materials not turning up, people not turning up. Usual debacle.
Yeah, the usual.
The problems of being busy as opposed to the problems of worrying about not being busy. It's interesting, isn't it?
I mean, that's great.
That's great. Of course it is. I think we've known it was going to be busy now for a few months, and just to see it come to fruition and see the invoices going out, you know, it's good. But I suppose the invoices come into match, don't they? But it's good to see. So what's our...
Our top topic. So we are going to, I'm excited about this week. We're going to discuss now or never. So when is the right time to start up a business?
Yeah.
How do you know? Like, when do you do it? Are you fit for it? Do you need money? Do you not need money? What are your family doing? What are they not? You know, there are so many different things we can discuss.
Yeah.
And obviously you've set up Wren and Chime. So you've got two very different... perspectives of your position of when you set up a company.
That's true.
So it's going to be...
And we obviously had Bernie, Mike and Morley.
We've had three guests, all who've set up their businesses, all in industries they knew.
Yeah.
So did that help? So I think, just...
That's a good place to start, isn't it? I mean, you know, do you... How much experience, maybe, do you need in your field before you have the confidence, ability, network... to take that plunge and do something on your own, you know?
I mean, yeah, surely having an expertise is going to help. I think I read a statistic that said something like, I mean, I can't believe it's this high, but 90% of new business startups fail within 3 years, and that's pretty much down to, like, the product or service just not being viable for market, you know? Whereas Bernie, Mike, and Nick... they all had experience, and you, in building in their particular fields.
Yeah.
So they knew the market was there.
They knew that there was somebody wanted tarmac.
Yeah.
They knew somebody wanted a ceiling. They knew somebody wanted a white line.
Yep.
And, you know, I thought some people might need some buildings built.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not as if we were coming out with an invention. So I think that's quite a good one. From my personal perspective, and I think we've got Reedy in later. We'll talk about that in a bit. There's an argument. Some people, and I think I would consider myself one of those, are just not built for the corporate world.
Yeah.
And that only dawns on you a bit later. You start understanding that companies have politics. You've got to play the game. Mm. And I think that can be a big driver because you just don't feel comfortable in that position. So you start thinking, well, what are my options? To move to another corporate
or
set up on your own? And
so what was... Do you remember the moment you thought, okay, I'm going to take this, I'm going to do it? Like, what triggered in your head that you thought, I'm going to do
this? I think it built up over time. I think I've got a... And we did with this with the podcast, funny enough. I have this habit of sort of telling lots of people things, like telling Archie I was going to do a podcast, for example. I felt like I could...
Archie's our producer.
I don't think I could face him, like, if I just said, yeah, I'm not doing it anymore. And I used to call my notice at my old firm the Hokey Cokey. because I kept on putting it in, pulling it out. It's a long story, and it came down to that I was going to start and work part time. But anyway, long story short, now I left on the grounds that I just felt that, and this is an important one, I think, I had nothing to lose.
Yeah, so, because did you have a mortgage at that point?
I did have a mortgage.
You had a mortgage,
but
not a family.
Without going into the exact details, I had like a 3-bedroom flat that I could rent out, two yeah. rooms, and not have a mortgage.
Yeah.
I tend to look at that and say, well, I'd be a bit crazy not to do it. And that's about not what the upside is, but it's being able to completely handle the downsides. Like worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Come back with my tail between the legs and say, any chance you got a job?
Yeah. And that's not so bad for you, you know.
It's not bad. You're in the same place. Yeah. Yeah. So you're balancing the risk up. You're saying, well, I'd rather give it a go. I think you probably have to be a bit of an optimist, I think.
Oh, I'd definitely say it. And I'd say all our guests have been.
So, yeah. So there's a personality trait there,
a problem solver. I feel like all three of them have different personalities, obviously, but they've all, like, under pressure, they've made decisions. They're not afraid to just make a decision and go with it. And I think that's probably.
And there's a naivety, I think. I think if you looked at, say, Mike, so in your job, in your position, do you have the networks? And if we think about Mike, his father was in the industry, and his father had relationships with aggregate suppliers, and he managed to get a deal, didn't he, where he got credit straight away. Now that's really hard. You don't go in. I mean, we had this problem. We used to have to pay for stuff up front. Where you don't phone up a supplier, get 20 grand's worth of gear. And they say, don't worry, pairs in 60 days. No chance. So that's a big deal. And so, and also Mike said he had access to labour again. So
two major things that made his cash flow easier.
But arguably he didn't have the customers.
Yeah.
We didn't really dig into that, did we? Whereas Bernie, on the other hand, one of his customers sat him down at his table. I don't know if we cut this bit out or not.
Is it?
He was a labour only supplier to a company, and for some reason that company didn't discontinue to get the work from the end user, and their client came down to his house, sat down at the dinner table with him, apparently, said, "Look, leave, we'll support you." So he knew the work was there, so he could therefore start putting things in place. I think quite often there's a bit of hedging in the background. You don't necessarily leave with nothing lined up. You know, I knew when I left I had some consultancy work I could lean back on. And here's a really important point, I think, is to be able to turn something into a business, you need to free up your time. So let's say you're like, take it back to that carpenter who's 22 and if he's continually on the tools, then he's not really going to grow.
He'll never do.
But if he can get enough money coming through to pay his wage while he goes out pricing jobs, looking at opportunities, frees up his time. And I felt that's what the consultancy allowed me to do at Wren. It allowed me to have my wage coming through, but releases me a day and a half a week to follow these, but they eventually,
something drops. So what was,
someone's crazy
what
enough
do you
to
think
do some
the,
work.
Like the big turn for Wren was, what was that moment you think that changed?
Well, it was the Olympics. So tell us
a bit about that. This is when I actually got involved.
Well, exactly.
In it,
so
at the beginning.
I think it was the beginning of our second year. First year, roughly, our sales had been about 280 grand or something, and we'd managed to keep 90,000, which was really, really good. I did a few building jobs, bit of consultancy, didn't really pay myself anything, and I got a phone call from an old site manager who was at the Olympics, good pal of mine, Darren Brown, to say there's a bit of work up here. Are you interested? Of course I am. From that point on, I was telling everyone I was involved at the Olympics.
Wait, and you had no labour really at this point?
It was just me. Yeah, me and Liz, to be fair. And I was like, okay. And it was some surveys, a bit of the site that they were going to let the workforce in. It was called the Workforce Entry. So I priced these surveys. I remember pricing them. I was on my honeymoon and my laptop just went dead. I was like, Dave! Dave's our IT spot. He used to sort me out with stuff. Anyway, I remember being in this sort of colonial
internet cafe.
Trying to use Dropbox and things, and I managed to get the pricing done. And from memory, it was about 18 grand's worth of work. It was some surveys. So anyway, I started getting involved in this job, and nobody really wanted to do the work. So I got that order for the 18 grand, and then we had to knock the buildings down, which was about 100 grand, and like break all the slabs up, got the order for that. And I just made myself extremely useful. And the next thing you know, I've got £1 million order for that, £1 million, 900 grand or something it was for the Workforce Entry. But I had the supply chain that would come and help me out. It was a ground worker that worked for us that I used to work with that trusted, do you know what I mean? So they trusted working for me, even though...
on your own now, but
if they hadn't known me, there's no way they sort of trusted me. They knew me, and then my father-in-law did the tarmacking, for example, on that job. That's that whole lady luck thing. Opportunity meets preparation. So I could have what they were asking me to do. I had the ability to do, and someone gave me the opportunity. And so we ended up doing. I think our final account there was £3.5 million. Made enough money to then give us a bank balance that meant. When we went out into the real world the following year, which you'll remember, we could do things like pay suppliers.
Well, you had a healthy bank account. Yeah. It looked very good for suppliers. So if someone's on the fence, like now thinking, do I jump? So you think, like, weigh up your risks. If you've not got a lot to lose, do it.
Well, I think it depends, doesn't it? And I think you probably know if you're the sort of person that would do it. I think I'm a very good example of someone just doing it. Do you know what I mean? I don't have a family that are in it. There was nothing. I just decided to do it.
Yeah.
Literally.
So maybe that's it. Just follow your sort.
Follow
of
your heart. Gut. I sort of deep down, I kind of knew that I would regret not doing it. And if you can get funding, think carefully. But again, that comes with lots of different.
I know
that funding because at Chime, people have approached us
to invest,
and we've been whilst we can still. Manage it ourselves.
Yeah.
Because then you're allowing other people in, you've got to report. But lots and lots of businesses obviously can't start without funding. Mm. And then they need heavy injections of cash at early stages. Be careful about putting your house on the line, But I remember signing personal guarantees. Amelia doesn't know this. Way back in the day. For
Oh, yeah, I guess your house.
Yeah. Not the house.
Okay, so our advice is do it.
Go. Yeah, jump in. Do it now.
Our guest today has actually done that, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
He was
so who's our guest
architect
today?
Ben Reed.
From Ben Reed Architects.
Yeah, he was an architect for years in a practice and he enjoyed it, but he wanted to just go out on his own.
So. And also he says that he wanted to be an architect again, not a manager. And I actually felt when I started Ren, I was actually doing some work.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't stop being on site. And I think.
Yeah, but even just producing documents, I really felt like I was being more industrious, which made me feel better. So, anyway.
So, Reedy. So, we'll get him on and we'll, see what he thinks about Now or Never, whether to jump. I mean, he did it.
He did it.
We'll hear his advice. Bitsy's Bites.
So we've added a bit to the pod, Bates's Bites, where we go to the QS extraordinaire, Master David Bates, to ask for advice and what he thinks of our topic of the day. Bates's Bites. Bates's Bites. Master.
What can I do?
Mate, quick one, man. We're just thinking we've got another pod on today. And our topic of the day is when's the right time to set up a business? And I thought, do you know what? Let's see if Bates's got any... nuggets of wisdom.
When you feel you have enough skill in yourself and contacts enough to start it, along with enough people around you, you can call upon for advice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you would say you need to embed yourself in the industry. Not wanting to put words in your mouth, Master, but you'd want to embed yourself in the industry enough to be able to have those skills and contacts.
Yes. When you started, Ren. Me and you used to have a little chat about, once every couple of months?
Yeah.
Just to say, how's it going?
Yeah, what do you think? I used to pick your brains quite a lot about quite a few things, to be fair.
Yeah, and, so you, once you've got people like that around you that you can ask advice from...
Yeah. Everybody needs a Batesy.
Everybody needs a mentor.
I mean, nice one. I'll use that. I think that's in line with what me and Bells were thinking, to be fair. So I always think it's worth calling you. So I better shoot, mate. I've got to go into the... got to go on air.
Take care.
Take it easy, man.
Cheers. Bye, mate.
Ben, it's a pleasure to have you on. You have been practicing as an architect for over 20 years.
Oh, don't remind me.
And in 2014, you took the leap to set up your own company, Ben Reed Architects. You've worked on a huge number of exciting and award-winning projects, including the UK's first net zero carbon house, designing buildings and housing for the homeless in Rwanda, and not forgetting the esteemed projects you've done for us here at REN.
Of course.
We cannot wait to hear your stories. And I definitely want to hear more about that business trip abroad to meet a billionaire. Welcome to Woolplug and Gromit, Ben.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
How's it going? Yeah, all good. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to see you all.
Safe enough journey over here? Easy enough?
A bit wet, but it was all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you've come from Surrey, haven't you?
Just come up from Surrey.
To sunny Watford.
Absolutely. Well, waiting to see that sun, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's horrible today. Okay, so first up, why did you want to be an architect? Did you always want to be one?
I think I always wanted to be an architect, to be honest with you. I actually come from a family of architects and artists, and I suppose I've got quite a creative family, but that didn't actually really have any real sort of influence on me. It's just architect. I've always loved drawing, painting, making things. I've always loved maths and problem solving and building things, and so architecture was always just a natural fit for me, really. It just ticked all the boxes of the things that I've always been interested in. And so I've kind of always really wanted to be an architect. And of course, you go through school and you think, well, maybe I should just have a look at some other professions. Yeah. And
Did you look at? Did you look at anything other than, did you come close to anything else?
Yeah. I looked at graphic design or doing something like that, but just didn't really...
wasn't a long enough course.
Is it really 7 years?
It's 5 years full-time study, and then two of those years are then working, but doing, exams and...
It's a long slog.
It puts a lot of people off, which...
Get out for armed robbery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy, because you're not really earning... So you're not earning for five years?
Yeah. No.
So. Student for 5 years. I was a student for 5 years, pretty much.
Not through choice, though, was it? That's another story.
The old retakes. Anyway. Yeah.
I did a couple of them. Yeah.
So
you've done your 5 years, and then you worked at Shepherd Robson. Tell us a bit about that.
So I did my diploma up in Newcastle, and quite an intensive course actually. And so I got to the end of that. We were working sort of like a 100-hour week.
What was that?
At Newcastle. Having finished that, I just took a bit of time off, and to be honest, just partied for 6 months or so. And then I was finally told by my parents I was no longer on the payroll and needed to get a job. And I wanted to do some travelling. I wanted to go abroad and stuff. But at that sort of time, there was a bit of a mini recession going on. And so I figured, well, I'll go down to London and join a big international practice, which then hopefully get me some opportunities to go then work abroad.
Okay.
And I wanted to go to Hong Kong and the Far East and work out there for a bit. But there was no meet opportunity. So I came to London, joined Shepherd Robson, which had offices in America and connections in Australia and the Far East. And that's what led me to join them more than anything.
Do practices sort of specialise in different types of architecture? There are some probably
smaller practices that will develop a niche in certain areas and stuff. I wanted to join quite a big practice because I didn't really want to specialise in anything.
So they covered
particular.
All the bases.
They did everything, yeah. And I was lucky enough during my time at Shepherd Robson to work in all different sectors. So, what sort of things did you do? Well, I started off, I mean, the first project I did when I joined there, I designed, worked on a master plan for a new city in China.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So that was just literally designing waterways, roads, business districts, and residential areas. So that was really interesting and a sort of baptism of fire in a way. And then got more into residential, which is probably then.
Is that where you've ended up?
So that's kind of where I've ended up. I mean, the last, I suppose, 5-6 years I worked at Shepherd Robson, I became more of a specialist in residential architecture. Right. And in some ways, that was one of the reasons I left, because I was becoming a bit pigeonholed into one particular sector. I like variety in my life. I like to sort of spread my wings. And so that was one reason why it was time for me to move on and go and sort of get back into other types of architecture. As it happens, I'm probably still doing just as much residential, I'm doing other stuff as well, and more commercial projects and leisure and retail projects as well.
So you felt you spent enough time to figure out what you wanted to do? Figured out the whole industry a little bit.
Well, I don't think you ever figure out the whole industry. I think you sort of find out what interests you and what you want to do and what you want to get out of life and your career and stuff and what kind of direction you want to take things. And I certainly needed a good 10, 15 years, however long it was at Sheppard Robson, to work that out and just sort of dip your toe into various sort of things and find out what...
Do you think that was to give you the confidence to do it, or you think it was a necessity?
I think it was probably a bit of both. Mm. I think I'm glad I've had that experience and that sort of diversity to be able to really understand what interests me and what, you know...
Sometimes is it just figuring out what you don't want to do? Like, you didn't necessarily want to be in a big corporate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think there's definitely that. And I think, you do, especially in your 20s and even getting to your 30s, you still have plenty of growing up to do. And work out what you want out of life generally and what what direction you want to take your career and stuff.
I remember my first PDP, the conclusion was I needed to grow up. I thought it was fairly reasonable.
Still asking those questions now, I think, but certainly of me. But
definitely of Rog too.
You never grow up.
Rog and I were talking earlier about when he sort of knew it was the right decision to take that leap. Do you remember that moment you thought, yep, I'm going to do it? And can you talk a bit around that?
I haven't worked quite some time at Sheppard Robson, and I recognise I was getting a bit stale there, and I'd also reached a point, just what you get when the big corporate organisations where there's lots, you get to sort of a senior level, and you lose sight of why you actually became an architect, because you've just become a manager, and you're just
following
sort of
process and things.
Yeah, you're not actually really designing particularly so much anymore, and you're not sort of really rolling your sleeves up and getting your hands dirty. It's just emails, phone calls, and dealing with problems, and so I was getting a bit tired of that. But also, then just the office politics that you get in big organisations when you get other. Sheppard Robson is a sort of, it was a third, fourth generation business, so there's no Norman Foster or Zaha Hadid
leading it
and saying this is what we're doing, guys. Yeah. There was a whole sort of team of senior management. Right. And they were all jostling for position, all backstabbing, and all just sort of saying, trying to prove themselves to each other. And it just, there's so much office politics and surrounding that, and actually just a bit unpleasant. And you just sort of think, well, why am I even bothering with this? Because actually, I don't want to be around some of you anyway, and this is just not fun.
That's interesting. I often think some people are suited to the corporate world, and knowing you I could almost tell that.
Yeah,
same, I think about myself. I don't think you're really necessarily a corporate goon.
I don't think I am. I think I've always been a team player, and I think I've always get on with people and can work with other people quite easily. But I think I've never been one to sort of
play the game
and get involved in all that sort of.
Yeah, it can catch you out.
It can catch you out. There are people who are great at it and love
exactly.
it.
Yeah.
But it's not.
And hats off to them, the people that can play.
Oh, I always admire them. I'm like, I can't. Well, that was partly why I was a teacher before I worked for Wren, and I absolutely didn't want that.
But I thought I'd also reached a bit of a glass ceiling as well there at Sheppard Robson, and I couldn't really take my career any further. I couldn't go and do anything else.
Yeah.
And there was no point me just leaving Sheppard Robson and going to work for a similar practice, because I'd just
been
out of the frying pan into the fire. And so I just wanted to go and do something different and just do something that allowed me to be a bit more creative, bit of a challenge, get some real variety in my work life, and do something that would potentially open up other doors.
Yeah.
And I didn't sort of set up my own business thinking, okay, well, this is now what I'm now going to do for the rest of my career until I retire. I thought we'd just go and do something different and see where it goes.
And I
never had a business plan. I never had a manifesto. Right. I was never Jerry Maguire, all this sort of thing. I was just sort of, I'll go and
give it a go.
I think I'll always sort of regret it if I didn't give it a go.
Yeah.
Now's the time to give it a go, because if I don't give it a go now, I'm going to just have to stay doing what I'm doing.
That is interesting.
Did you have a wife and children at that point?
Yeah,
because
I
think that's often a way up, isn't it?
I think it is. My wife is actually very entrepreneurial, and she's set up her own businesses.
What does she do?
Well, she looks after the kids at the moment, but she's actually just setting up her own business. But
is that
she,
a job? Is it looking after
the kids? Only joking. Toughest job in the world.
I must admit, I wouldn't swap places with her.
No, but I've heard you say that. You know, it's way easier coming to work.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say that too.
Is it her big business she had? She her voucher.
Yeah.
So she set up Welcher.
Oh, did she?
Okay. She sold it to the Daily Mail. Became Welcher.
That's where the big house comes from. That's where the Porsche comes from.
Oh, you noticed that?
Yeah, of course. never miss a porker in the car park.
Well, it certainly doesn't come from architecture wages, that's for sure.
Commercial break. Rog, we've had an email from the sponsor. They're really not happy.
What?
I know. So last week, you missed off one of their key functionality.
What did I miss?
Skills, Rog.
Ah, skills, of course, right. Skills Matrix. The Skills Matrix is a way that you can manage your operative skills in real time. So you can tell on any given site who's on site, but not only what their name is and what their trade is.
What else?
But what skills they've got. Have you got a banksman? Have you got someone with confined space training? Chime will tell you. So beat that, anyone else, and buy Chime.
So that was definitely a big factor in making the decision, though, having a wife and kids and, how you got to support
work-life, balance.
Getting that work-life balance, and that was a big part of it, and being able to sort of be more flexible in how much work you do and stuff, and spending time with the family. But it was also, we had I think one child just born at the time. And soon after, when I went full time in my own business, our second child was just born, and so there was no other forms of income coming in.
Yeah,
and so
that's a bit
pressure.
Daunting, maybe.
It's a bit daunting, and so it's why I kind of ease myself into it.
Yeah, you went part time for a bit, which is a good idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I wasn't totally honest with Shepherd Robson.
You did that with Archie's, didn't you?
similar.
Yeah, I think...
it's a sensible...
You're hedging your bets a bit.
Yeah,
you've got to sort of look after number one a little bit on these things. Yeah. And I sort of... So I went part-time. I wouldn't tell them exactly what I was
part-time
doing.
Part-time is a loose way of putting it.
And I was obviously... I didn't take any clients from Shepherd Robson or anything like that. I was set up my own thing, but I was just following my own leads up and slowly building up my own business to a point where, I got enough work booked in that I knew I could pay the mortgage for
less of a gamble.
Months. Yeah, I had 6 months covered in fees, booked in. So, I'll give this a go full time and have 6 months.
Six months.
And if it all goes horribly wrong,
that's exactly what Rog was saying.
Exactly.
It's as long as I can pay my bills, the overheads for the next month, I can then go out and do my thing and find new customers.
So it's quite logical when you think about it, isn't it? You get to a point, like you said, you hit a glass ceiling in a company, you're a certain age, you know that the only real option you've got outside of going on your own is to go and put yourself in the same situation with another company.
I mean, it's basically a midlife crisis.
That's
basically what happened. But that's what my accountant always tells me. That's why I'm doing
it. Not so bad midlife crisis, really.
Think it's a great midlife crisis.
But I think everyone reaches that sort of point in their life and is like, okay, well, I either stick with this, what I'm doing now, and I'm committed to it, and this is what I'm going to do, or now's the time to go.
But deep down, you knew that.
Is there any? Is there any going back for you now you've done it yourself?
Oh, I'd never go back.
Yeah,
no,
it's funny, isn't it?
Not a single regret.
Yeah,
not a single
That's
regret.
Awesome.
And I think it's it is. I'm very lucky, to have sort of found it and it's worked out well. I mean, who knows? Could go horribly wrong in 6 months, and I'll be.
Is that something you think about much? Because that's one of the things that I worry about. Is that everything going?
The big worry that I worry less.
Yes, as time goes on.
I mean, the big worry for me setting up my own business was, where's the work going to come from, and am I going to be able to pay the bills each month? Yeah. And that certainly kept me awake at night for a time, and it's amazing how never really done much by way of marketing or putting myself out there networking, but it never ceases to amaze me that having some good contacts and, you know, good friends like Roger to put a bit of work my way.
Yeah, well, you're obviously very personable as well, which helps, doesn't it?
It does, and I think, you know, and the phone has continued to ring, you know, even, you know, through a global pandemic and stuff like that, we've been all right.
Well, I think you strike the balance between the architectural creativity and also the practical common sense. I mean, I've introduced you to customers in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
And they very much like the fact that you can quickly understand their design requirements, and then as a builder, we think, well, he's not getting carried. You know, there's a balance, isn't there, between vision and...
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of different architects out there, and there are those who are just very strong-minded. Okay, this is... I'm a creative darling.
Become attached
to it. You know, and they come turn up and they're burying cape, and this is, this is how it's going to be. And for some clients and projects...
The bury works.
It works.
What's been your sort of top project over the years, do you think?
I was lucky enough to be involved in designing the UK's first
net zero carbon home, which won lots of awards. Yeah, I said that in the intro. Yeah, what does that mean exactly?
That's like, interesting. What does that mean, really?
Yeah. Well, it's basically just a timber house with lots of bells and whistles.
I looked at it. It looks awesome. It's got this sort of curvy
timber and roof. Yeah.
Where is it? A house?
It's called what's it called?
Project Lighthouse.
Lighthouse, and it's actually around the corner in Watford.
Well, not anymore.
It?
They knocked it down. Oh. But, wasn't that good?
Okay, moving over that.
It's gone to landfill.
there's a club. There's a club no architect wants to be in. It's called the Rubble Club. No architect wants to see a building they've designed knocked down. Club. And unfortunately, I'm in the Rubble Club already.
With your favourite one.
No, gutted. But no, I mean, it was never meant to last. No one lived in it. It was a prototype house.
Oh, got it.
So it was there as part of an exhibition. So it wasn't. Wasn't the owners sort of living there? I think
this is really just not efficient enough.
This just doesn't work. It's horrible. For me, I think there's two reasons what I really got out of it. One is we won a lot of awards and I went to a lot of parties.
I'm thinking that might be the leading.
But the other one, it really helped me understand about what sustainability means. And I think as any architect has a passing interest in sustainability, some more so than others. But I think sustainability is a word that's sort of thrown around and not really understood by a lot of people. I think a lot of people think it just means a solar panel on the roof or a wind turbine or something.
So a lot of lip service paid to it, maybe.
A lot of lip service is paid to sustainability. And everyone says, okay, we've got to be sustainable. Yeah. We've got to do a sustainable house and, you know, make it airtight and over-insulate the walls. And it's about so much more than that. And I think that's what that suddenly changed my outlook a little bit about what sustainability means. Is not just about the eco stuff, it's actually about doing something that will last.
Well, I want to hear about this trip with the billionaire.
Well, yeah, what was that? So when we went to Austria.
Vienna.
You were working as the architect for Wren.
It was a scheme we're doing
outside Heathrow. We needed to get an architect involved. There was an architect, but we got you involved to help bring the vision, I believe, of the owners.
So a bit like this, like helping them see.
Was it something to do with that? Can you remember?
It was something like that. I think, the architect. Well, they had some various designers. I think in Austria. Who designed a lot of the concept side of things, but they needed a UK architect to deal with the technical side of it and deal with the
translate that into a building. And they were very driven. Design-wise, weren't they? For some reason, for many reasons, but the customer was extremely particular about his design. So they said that they had elements of the job in Austria that we should look at to implement them in our design. So Reed and I got a plane across to Vienna, and the office was like a big, massive townhouse knocked together, amazing place. And we got walked around like the toilets and things, and then this is what we want. And we were looking at each other. Well, it's just a toilet.
And then they'd mocked up all these sort of kitchens and all sorts.
It was a crazy environment. And then they sent us to their hotel, didn't they? They said you can go to a hotel around the corner.
Well, they did. I think they I left the office. And they wanted to show us Vienna, so we did this sort of tour. Roger and I was like, this is so dull. Just just get us to the bar.
And we ended up in the, we went into this restaurant, and it was closed. They just opened it for us in this hotel. And they had like plates of sushi. We were sort of looking at each other. Like, it was weird. Yeah,
how far did we go with this?
Yeah, exactly.
And then we settled in.
Was the owner there?
The owner's, like, he lived in his office was like a penthouse on the top. Yeah. It was really weird.
Did you go into that? Was it like James Bond?
It was like an office. And he had like a corner office in there. And Reed and I were like, what are we doing here? I mean, it felt like it was like a James Bond sort of.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was cool. It was a really interesting job that was for us.
So you won the work.
Yeah, we were already doing the work.
But you just had to finalise like the details of design. Got it. And you went there to see it.
So you got your travel in the end, didn't you?
Jet set to Austria.
It was one night and one night. It wasn't even a night, was it?
No, we got last
flight out the same day, didn't we?
To Heathrow that night.
They didn't put you up in the hotel there?
I think we probably could have stayed there, but we were like...
I think they saw how much we were eating and drinking and thought, let's get rid of us.
We did a lot of sushi in that place, from memory.
Yeah. And we often ask our guests if they've had a big role model in their life professionally. Have you got anyone?
I don't know there's any one person that would spring to mind, other than Roger, obviously.
Jamie Thigston. Don't you think he looks a bit like Thigston?
He's losing his hair a bit there now, isn't he? I don't think he's got
the... He hasn't got the bonnet, mate.
He hasn't got the bonnet anymore.
Not quite. Funny, he was at the Grove the last time I was at the Grove.
What was he doing?
I don't know yet. Getting hair implants, maybe. Having a beer, I think. I think it was him, anyway.
I met Jamie Thigston when I was in a bar in Westbourne Grove around there, and I was with a mutual friend of ours who grabbed Jamie Thigston, dragged him over to the table we're all sat at, and said, "Hey, Jamie, don't you think my mate looks just like you?" And Jamie sort of looked at me and said, "No."
No. He's got better hair than me. Yeah. Funny enough, I bumped into Peter Jones the other day in Starbucks, and we stopped... looked at each other, the guy from the Dragon's Den.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like we were looking at each other. I'm exactly the same height. Do you know when you bump into someone? We had face masks on, so it was a bit weird.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was like he was the same build as me. I had shaved like me, and it was a bit
I love it. You thought it was like looking into a mirror. Yeah. He probably
and he was like, who is this?
Can we swap?
Who's this scrub?
Bank cards.
Yeah. He was in a Lamborghini, and I was on foot. Who does Bells look like? I've heard a few things about who you look like.
You know what? And this is like me bigging myself up massively, but when I was like 7, 8, people thought I looked like Julia Roberts.
Yeah, I can see Julia Roberts now.
But that was when I was like 7 or 8. No, I haven't had it recently. What have I had? I've had some bad ones. Oh, Imogen Stubbs or something.
I don't know who that is. Do you know who
I remember looking her up. I was like, that's...
Yeah, sometimes when someone says you look like somebody, you're like, that's a good one.
It can be the worst.
Like,
oh, no.
Yeah, be careful asking that question.
Yeah. Who do I look like?
Well, Shrek.
role models.
So, I don't think there's been any particular role model, I think, throughout my life or career. I mean, but, you know, there's people, there's architects... famous architects I've loved the work of Richard Meier or Alvar Aalto or Frank Gehry.
I feel like I know Norman Foster.
Everyone knows Norman Foster.
I feel like who else do I know?
I don't know.
I love
Ben Reed.
Ben Reed,
this is my go-to.
Okay, cool. And to finish off some quick fire questions.
All right.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Oh, don't be an architect.
they all say that, don't they?
Everyone
says don't do it.
What is it with the industry?
Best advice. I think my dad has always been good for advice and stuff. And I was really, you know, going back to the previous question, but he's always someone that I've always looked up to. And his advice was, don't be greedy. Don't be...
greedy, greedy.
Don't be greedy, greedy. Yeah. He was always nicknamed greedy as well.
Was he?
And follow things that you're interested in, and don't get caught up with money. And just enjoy what you're doing, and just find something that.
Do you think coming to that conclusion has got something to do with your age? Because I feel at my age now, I would sort of feel the same. But I think when you're sort of maybe even mid to late 20s, it's more about being a little bit greedy, not necessarily with money, but enjoying yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember just all you really thought about on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday was Friday night. And then all you did on Monday, Tuesday was debrief about Friday, Saturday night.
Oh, completely.
And so it's very hard when your world revolved around, which it really did. I mean, I don't think we were abnormal either. I think that was...
I don't think so, no. I think that's everyone just goes, and it's just part of the growing up.
It's part, exactly.
So once you got
that out,
wise.
Once you got that out of your system,
family, you settle down, have a family, and you sort of realise what's important.
Perspective just changes,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely, and you have your midlife crisis and you
set up a business and build a ridiculously big house.
And grow your hair long.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So top tip for, you know what, this could be twofold. Top tip for either someone becoming an architect now or for setting up a business.
Well, I suppose in both those questions, I mean, I think just take your time. I think particularly in architecture, because it is... it is a subjective thing, and there are, you know, it is a design, it is a creative-led industry. You need to get some experience, and you need to just go and work for one or two other practices, and just find out, you know, what it is you're really interested in, and what really, sort of floats your boat, and a kind of, what designer you really are, and whether you are a designer at all.
I like your idea of just sort of taking your time, be patient, find out as much as you can. You know, we've talked before about being curious, asking questions, just like ride it out for a bit.
And there are certain industries we talked about earlier. Let's say you're a chippy or a trade, you could become very proficient in 4 or 5 years. You could be a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
By the time you're 22, 23, you could go and run a carpentry business. Yeah. You could.
I think it's very interesting. I was lucky early on in my time at Shepherd Robson, I worked on site for a year doing the fit-up mentioned before. And I learned so much just being on site. Yeah. And actually, I think architects would do really well if they took 6 months out to go and be a chippy.
Yeah, I think that's a really,
or go and be an electrician or something.
Even a site agent, yeah.
And just you learn
that's
learn
really,
these things.
That's really good.
And it feeds back into the profession. I mean, architects have always been described as the jack of all trades and master of none. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I like that. That's why I love being an architect, because I don't know a lot about anything, but I know a little bit about a lot of things.
Yeah, we've read a quote. Yeah,
quote out. That was funny.
Yeah,
and that's great. That gives me variety and stimulating. And so I'd love to go and be a chippy for 6 months, or go and
I think that's such a good our quick fire questions have not been very quick fire, but I think that's really good. Like, a top tip for an architect is, take your time and get out on site.
Go and see how things are put together.
No, I think
so. I found that definition of an architect. So this is this kind of like these is like a meme going around WhatsApp.
Is it rude?
It's a man who knows very little about a great deal and keeps knowing less and less about more and more until he knows practically nothing about everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just thought, and then the engineer's a funny one. A man who knows a great deal about very little and goes on knowing more and more about less and less until he knows practically everything about nothing.
It's very good.
I know, I thought that was good.
I like that. Yeah, but it's very true though.
It can't, I suppose it's a
you said
meme
it yourself.
For a reason.
Yeah, we were laughing about that.
Yeah.
And if you could bring one thing to a desert island, what would it be?
Oh goodness, that's that sort of dreaded job interview question, isn't
it?
You know, it's
what you're not good at. I just try too hard.
Pencil and paper. What do architects use?
Yeah, I learned the other day about desert islands. I learned the other day there's no canaries on Canary Island.
Okay.
It's the same thing about the Virgin Islands.
Right. Yeah.
There's no canaries on Virgin Islands.
Wait, get that one out. Ding.
Dad joke.
Yeah. Cut that out, can't we?
What would you bring?
I think the boring answer to that question is, I'd love to go and build. I'd go and build stuff, take a
bucket and spade then.
Build a city, put a hotel, and sit back on my sunbed and watch the cash come in. But
toolbox.
Toolbox.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
There's another joke about going on a desert island with Heidi Klum. Shall I tell that joke?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so this will get cut out.
This is under comedy on Spotify. For some reason.
I'm here all night.
Yeah, we're trying to change that.
So there's a guy gets washed up on a desert island with Heidi Klum. And after a day or two, he says to Heidi, look, we're here together, we're stuck here, should we get together? Yeah. And so she says, yeah, well, okay, fair enough. They get together and they the year, weeks and months go by, and they have this beautiful relationship. Without going into detail, and so and then 6 months down, this guy says to Heidi, he said, "Look, you don't mind? Would you, mind just sort of putting drawing a moustache on your top lip?" And Heidi says, "Well, no, okay, I'll put a moustache on." And then he says, "Would you mind just putting on my clothes, some men's clothing?" So Heidi says, "Okay, fine, yeah, whatever you want, I'll put these clothes on." And then he says, "Would you mind if I call you Phil?" Heidi says, "Well, a bit strange, but okay, yeah, you can call me Phil." And he says, this guy says, "Oh, thanks." Right, so he turns out, "Phil, you'll never guess who I'm shagging."
Ah, good one.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Sorry about that. Is that used up the hour?
Yeah. Good filler.
Oh, well, Ben, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, man, my pleasure. Thanks.
You didn't even mention the charity work as well, which is great, because I don't like to talk about
it. You know what? I was just thinking that like, I cannot
believe...
It's like
he's done it, he's done his charity. Yes. Yeah. That'll make the cut.
No, but that's... Yeah, I'm sorry, because I did really want to hear about that.
That's fine. Yeah. So I've been involved with a charity... for a while.
I don't like to talk about it, but I'm going to reel this off.
I do a lot of work for charity, but I really don't like to talk about it. But,
yeah, so what have you been doing?
Rwanda, I've been involved with this charity called Rwanda Action.
Right.
Give them a bit of a plug. And they do all sorts of sustainable initiatives, actually. There's a really poor region in the southwest of Rwanda. And they sort of do teacher training, teaching teachers how to teach,
right,
and teaching people how to farm properly and sustainably, and teaching skills for people about making craft. And they set up little businesses and ship all the goods that they make in Rwanda to the UK and sell them in UK shops and stuff. Well, I've been involved in a number of projects out there. I've designed a village for disabled children.
Wow.
Okay. It's a lot of disabled children just get abandoned because they can't
look after them.
The parents can't look after them, and the kids can't work on the land and all this stuff, so they just get abandoned. So there's a centre for disabled kids and help them sort of develop their own sort of skills and slowly ease them back into society and be able to sort of...
So what have you done? Designed that, and has it been built out?
That's been built, and I've just designed and sort of follow on from that. So the kids that sort of graduate when they get to 18... They've learned a few skills. I'm now doing a centre where they can go and live by themselves and have a series of workshops where they can actually then make
stuff.
Cards or
living
and working. And then this centre then has a little shop and a cafe where we can actually then sell the stuff that they make.
So did you go out there?
So I've been out there a couple of times. Cool. I've been out there actually a year before, I think it must have been now. And so, and I've redesigned the housing out there because a lot of housing just falls down. They have major earthquakes
and rainfall. What are the houses built out of? Mainly
sticks and mud, basically.
Are they, really?
Yeah, with crinkly tin roofs. But they're a lot, so they get really heavy rainfall and a lot of it, because it's very hilly as well, and so like landslides, and so a lot of the houses just collapses. So what we did was just sort of, not completely redesigning it, because that wouldn't be sustainable, because you've got to design something that the locals can actually build and with materials
and
that they've got out there,
maintain
and will stay. But just design, putting things together in a slightly different way that is a bit more structurally sound, that will stop insects and termites coming in, that will withstand earthquakes, will keep the rain out. So,
And how did you get into that?
So it was through a family, actually, contact who set that charity up. And
your family contact.
My family contact.
Okay, cool.
So,
that's really good. Oh, that sounds.
Yeah, that was awesome.
How good was that?
That was so good.
Yeah, really interesting.
So nice to have him on.
Yeah, and it also tied in what we talked about earlier, being doing a job long enough, figuring out what you want to do, taking a plunge, time of life, weighing up risks, not wanting to go into another corporate job. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, really good. And his advice for youngsters going in, I know I probably banged on a bit about that, but that was really good as well.
No,
you
definitely.
Know, take your time and like really learn your trade and
stuff.
And
what a charitable fellow as
I
well.
I know.
So, yeah,
isn't that awesome?
That was great. Enough. I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Yep.
So what's going on? What are you doing now?
What am I doing now? We're
have
getting on Wagamamas.
Should we have a beer with Reedy?
Have a beer with Reedy. Have a Wagamamas. Oh, I know what I need to do. Scunners is... telling me I need to do the O&Ms.
Oh, no.
Poor guy, he's doing all the printing, so I need to go. I actually do need to
go and
see him.
Some operations and maintenance manuals. Oh, well, good luck with that. Unfortunately, I don't have to do that.
But we will be back next week.
Yep, look forward to that. We'll have an exciting guest on, no doubt. Still working on that, but I think I know who it's going to be. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
See you next week.
Adios. Bye now.